Howdy and welcome to River Talk, a podcast hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, our big topic is, well, paddling season's just around the corner, so what do you need to do to get ready? But first, we'd like to start with some news of the week. So, Zach, Priscilla, anything you want to talk about?
Sure. Zach, why don't you start it off? Really? You were in D.C. this last week advocating for Wild Rivers and thanking legislators.
Yeah. I mean, as a lot of people probably know, Senate Resolution 47 passed. Trump signed it last week, which is pretty cool, and it protects rivers and land across the country, adds new wilderness. I can't remember how many miles of Wild and Scenic, but I think it's like 600 miles of Wild and Scenic rivers. 250 here in Oregon. It's really good for Oregon. There's some not so good stuff in it for Alaska and other places.
Yeah.
But they have Republican senators, so that's what they get. And so the president signed the bill. So we were in D.C. last week thanking different members of Congress and their staffs. And also kind of laying the groundwork for like what we'd like to see next. So for me, that was, I'm asking for protection of the Rogue, which got pulled out of the bill. Protection for the Owyhee, which has been a long sought after thing that's a little controversial because the locals there, some of them are against it. And then asking for protection of the South Kalmiopsis, which is mainly tributaries of the Smith and Illinois rivers, which are really important. So it was really fun. Like, it's really, you know, going to D.C., anybody can do it. You can, it's about $1,500 a person to do this. You buy a plane ticket, you get an overpriced hotel room, you pay a ton of money for Ubers. You just email your members of Congress. You rarely get to meet with them in person. It's usually like a super smart 25-year-old aide. And they'll make a meeting with you. You can talk to them about whatever you want. It's pretty nice. And so I was there partially to advocate for some outfitting stuff for the first couple of days. And then a few of our river guides flew in. And we made the rounds again to talk about conservation with a few river guides. So, and they set up, some of these river guides set up meetings with their own members of Congress on their own and went and saw them by themselves, which was pretty cool too.
So, awesome.
Yeah, that's it. It was a good trip.
Cool. I just pulled up my paper where I had a bunch of stats written down. So Oregon has had the title of having the most protected individual rivers in the U.S. under Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And now we're in second place to Alaska for the most miles. So we have almost 2,200 miles, and Alaska has just over 3,200. So we have about 1,000 miles to catch up. So hopefully we'll do that for maybe in this upcoming year with some more protections.
Yeah, and a couple interesting facts about Oregon. We had by far the most individual designations with 58. Next was California with 43. Alaska doesn't have that many individual designations. It's just the rivers that are protected are long. You know, they're like really long designations. Where we have, the river Styx here in Oregon, I think is like half a mile of designation. Yeah. So there's some really short ones here too. But we passed California. California had the second most miles. Now we have the second most miles to Alaska. But we definitely have the highest concentration. Even before this bill, 2% of our river miles in Oregon were protected versus California and Alaska, which were 1%. So we definitely have the highest concentration of protected river, even before this bill passed.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Last night we had an event where everyone came and thanked Senator Wyden and Representative Blumenhauer for those efforts and talked about stuff that Zach was talking about, trying to continue to protect the Kalmiopsis, Owyhee area. And something that is additionally interesting that needs a little bit of advocacy is the Recreation Not Red Tape Act. So there's a pretty important part, at least from American Whitewater's perspective, there's an important part of that bill where federal natural resource agencies are charged with managing recreation or incorporating recreation as a part of what they do. So it seems weird when you first say it, but then when you think about like the Department of Energy and how dams relate to recreation, it makes a lot of sense that you would add that to how they manage. Same goes for, you know, like the Forest Service and transportation entities, possibly, that just recreation exists. It doesn't exist in a silo, so it makes sense that there should be interagency coordination so that there's better opportunities for it and better management plans for it. So keep an eye out for that. I'm not sure where it is right now, but it would certainly be something for all recreation people to be aware of and advocating for. And then final boring update about legislation. In Oregon, we have House Bill 2835, which started out as an ambitious effort to address some of the problems that a lot of states have around defining what waterways support recreation. Navigability determinations are really outdated, not useful for recreation, and really expensive and require a federal court determination. So that's really all we have right now in terms of protecting like people's rights to portage access some rivers. We unfortunately had to pare that bill down into basically three amendments, which still do some pretty cool things. One is that it requires a public process for any closures on state lands related to public waterway access. It also requires state agencies to produce a report in Oregon that shows the number of access points that have been opened, the number of access points that have been closed every year. And so the public could see, you know, what their public agencies are doing regarding waterway access. And the third part is that it requires the Department of Transportation to consider feasibility of improvements to access to a waterway on any new state bridge or reconstructed bridge projects. And there was similar legislation about the bridges passed in Washington already, and it's played out well so far.
Priscilla, what's an example? Where would this affect us?
Well, so a good example of the bridge access is on the Sandy River. So Revenue Bridge was recently replaced, and when they replaced it, they actually got rid of waterway access and parking. And now it's caused a lot of problems because private property owners are not happy because people now are being displaced to having to park near their houses, and their developed access is pretty much gone. So that's a really good example of one place. There's other places where like there might be a bridge that's being reconstructed for some reason, and it's on a river that people have been unofficially maybe going down a scree slope. And say this Marine Board bill where it gives waterway access grants to non-motorized user groups is available. Someone like American Whitewater could apply for that grant, get the grant. If ODOT says it's a reasonable place to develop stairs or even just something as simple as a trail, they could use it for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I do. The navigability thing I think is interesting because I've been on the opposite side of like navigability comes with some challenges as well, or interesting. There's interesting outcomes of a waterway being designated navigable because then you all of a sudden, if you run the risk of the Coast Guard being involved in the oversight of it. So an example would be if you're a fishing guide on the Rogue using a, you know, a little 9-horsepower kicker motor to go back up river and refish spots on your drift boat. If you are below one of the bridges in Grants Pass, you have to have a Coast Guard like captain's license. Like you have to have a 6-pack license through the Coast Guard. You go take navigation exams. It's expensive. It's a multi-year process. But if you're above that bridge, you don't have to have that. So there are, you know, in certain places within the guiding community, there are some challenges that come with that navigability ruling or designation, I guess. So other side of the equation, I suppose.
Definitely.
But one other, you know, topic. Priscilla, you got any more news of the week? You good?
I think I'm good.
So here in Idaho, we've had a couple months of contentious situation around steelhead fishing in the state based on some paperwork not being properly filed with NOAA Fisheries. And that has been resolved as of like last Thursday or Friday. So steelhead fishing season is now open everywhere in Idaho, which is a great thing. So,
Eric, this has been something I've been like kind of following, but I haven't wanted to learn about because it sounds really complicated and hard to figure out and solve. And so I know super smart, hardworking people solved that problem. Who was that? Who do we have to thank for making that happen?
Well, I mean, ultimately,
other than you, because I know you worked hard on it.
But no, yeah. I didn't. I didn't work. No, I more followed along than I did anything else. You know, the problem was ultimately solved by NOAA Fisheries finishing their paperwork. And, you know, I think a lot of people didn't end up taking the hit that they otherwise would have it because, you know, groups of local community members like the Riggins, the folks down in Riggins, Idaho, some of the folks up on the Clearwater, some of the folks in Lewiston, you know, these communities got together with their voice and basically fought back saying, you're not, you know, this is going to ruin our town if you guys close down steelhead fishing. This is a major driver of our economy. So there was some of those local people did a really good job of organizing and putting up a fight and getting in the right place and then coming to an agreement with some of these environmental organizations that in their push to make sort of a statement, I don't think fully recognized the impact that they were going to have on people who are naturally aligned in what they wanted. You know, that said, there were some people that got left out of those deals that got pretty financially impacted. I mean, I know people that probably are losing, you know, $30,000 to $50,000 of revenue this year because of fishing closures that stayed in place. And that really sucks. So there were some real victims within this. But, you know, I think the Idaho Outfitter and Guides Association did a lot of pushing to help make sure that NOAA Fisheries stayed on this and got it done as fast as possible. They were pushing, you know, they had Idaho senators calling NOAA, making sure that happened. We had a resolution passed through the Idaho House to, you know, basically say, went through the House and Senate saying that we support, you know, steelhead fishing in Idaho and we want this industry back up and running, that kind of stuff. So there was a resolution passed that way. So there was pressure from a lot of people to, you know, just make sure this happened. But at the end of the day, it was really just no one needed to finish the paperwork in a timely fashion. And ultimately they did after, you know, not doing it and causing the whole problem to begin with. So there you have it. I don't know if that really answered your question, but it's sort of a big picture of what, you know, the overall scenario was.
I just want to know who to thank. And what I'm hearing is Idaho Outfitter and Guides Association.
They certainly played a part. Okay. Like they did. I think at the beginning, it was more behind the scenes pressuring like the power brokers to call the right people, you know, versus sort of the public push that was some of the other groups like the Riggins Rural Community Alliance or Idaho Rural Community Alliance, whatever it is. They were sort of the public face, but IOGA was doing a lot behind the scenes. And then, you know, IOGA, I think, kept the pressure on throughout the process, which was, I think, ultimately helpful to making sure it happened on time.
Okay. I'm learning through visits or just all this that by being involved and like talking to your state representatives or federal representatives, when things go wrong, if you have that relationship, you can solve them. Or if you know how the system works, these problems can be solved. We live in a really cool country where, you know, you can, these things can be worked through. You just have to have those contacts and put time into it. It doesn't automatically happen.
Yeah.
It takes time, though. It's building these relationships takes a lot of time, but it definitely pays off when we need it to.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, should we move on to our big topic, prepping for the paddling season, seeing as how the snow is melting and the rivers are rising?
Yeah.
So we thought it'd be a good idea today to talk about, you know, as you start to dust off your gear, the things you should think about as you start to head back out towards the water. Zach, you want to start us off?
Yeah, well, so our first trip is tomorrow. We have what we call a class 4 rowing school where we teach people to row like intermediate advanced kind of rowing stuff here in Head River. And I'm loading that trip today and going through all of our gear. And it's just been a good reminder to like open up the first aid kit, change the Advil if it's expired. There's other medications that might be expired. Double check that everything's there because at the end of the season, you're boating or just over time, stuff gets forgotten. I went through our safety kits and noticed that one of them was missing a pulley, just little things like that. So, first of all, just going through your safety gear and first aid gear is a great way to get ready for the season. Even if you've been boating all winter, right now is a great time for like spring cleaning. So, I'm a big fan of that. And, also just going like tighten up bolts here and there on frames, things that might've gotten loose over the winter or they rusted shut is something we noticed too. So going through our frames and our Orlocks and just checking everything works right. Have a can of WD-40 out today, just cleaning everything up. So that's the first thing I've noticed. You guys have anything to add to preseason gear stuff?
I think Zach, I think that's great. I think going over your gear, you know, one of the things, it's like, I remember in my kayak I got in a couple years ago, like, you know, after not boating all winter, you get in the spring, you're like halfway through a run and you realize the bolts that are holding your foot or your like bulkhead, you know, in place have like fallen off, you know, and are rattling around inside your boat just because you didn't check and tighten them down.
Yeah.
So no, I think the going over your gear piece is super, super important. Med kits, you know, on a commercial side, or if you're going out for multi-day stuff, is really, really important to go through that, because that stuff does go bad.
Yeah. Something I've been doing, and I know, like, we'll preface this with, there's lots of people that have been boating all winter, kayaking, rafting, all those things, but
in your neck of the woods.
That's true. But something that I'm realizing is my rolling in my kayak has gotten really rusty because it's been really cold and it's hard to paddle when you're cold and you're more likely to maybe walk things because you don't want to roll over. So I've been going to pool sessions in a warm pool, and that's been really, really nice to kind of dust off some of the rustiness in paddling that has come from, well, at least in Oregon, we had a long period of time where just no water was in. And then we had some water, and then we had a ton of water, and then it snowed, and now the snow's starting to melt. So it was kind of a weird season where there wasn't a ton of
paddling.
I'm pretty sure
we had the worst paddling winter ever.
Yeah, it's been rough.
Someone else was saying recently, but I think we're going to have one of the best paddling springs ever. So
yeah, it's looking really good.
Yeah.
Make up for it.
Absolutely.
I think that's an important point there, and that, you know, it's easy to want to kind of go like be off the couch hero. You know, it's like we haven't been boating much. I haven't boated. I've been in my kayak since last, you know, middle of the summer or fall, I guess, maybe doing some play boating before everything froze up here. And all of a sudden, you know, the snow's going to start melting. The rivers are going to come up. And it's really tempting to just want to go and jump back in and feel like I'm going to be as good as I was when the boating season ended last year. And I'm going out to boat harder stuff than I was probably doing when the season ended last year. And for sure not going to be as good. You know, it's like riding a bike. You don't totally forget it, but you do get rusty. The muscles do kind of go away. So it's important to remember that you should go out and maybe get in a couple of laps that feel like warm up laps before you go jump into the real meat of things.
Yeah. I think as you get older, it gets even worse. I remember when I was younger, I was so proud of like, we jumped off the couch and ran the gnar on our first day out. You're like, that was something you could do. I could do in my 20s. But now I need a solid week of boating before I even go do like class 4.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also checking on the gear side of things, making sure that your dry suits and all that sort of stuff are in good order. I actually just put on one of my newer dry suits and realized it had a couple leaks in it, which I'm definitely going to make sure to take care of before I go on any overnighters or anything of that nature. So that would be a bummer to have wet layers after spending a full day on the river and getting to camp. Making sure that like your throw rope is not in a weird condition if you haven't used it all season, and just doing that initial gear check if you're someone that's kind of hung up the boating gear for the winter and now are just taking it out again. I think on the condition side of things, you have to think about like the conditions of the rivers. Like here, in particularly in the Eugene area, some rivers have been hit pretty hard with ice and snow, and unfortunately there's a lot of wood in some of them. So being prepared, even if it's a run that is your backyard run that you're really familiar with, the first time going down after, if you're in an area where there was a lot of snow and it's an area that's not used to having a lot of snow or ice, that you're being really careful in making sure to scout and being just really safe if it's your first time on the water after a long time away from it.
You know, the thing I like to see people do as the season's coming around, especially if you haven't been boating or, you know, whatever, go out and throw your throw bag three or four times.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, throw it, restuff it, throw it, restuff it. One, just make sure that there's no knots and stuff in it. Make sure that, you know, there's no scratches in the line or, you know, any of those things that just getting it out of the bag will help you see. But two, like, that is a skill that you lose, or it gets to where it's not as good if you don't practice it. So don't be practicing it when you need it. Go practice it a couple times at the start of the season.
Which is really good advice, but do you guys actually do that?
I throw mine at least, well, I mean, I use mine year round.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
Like, I'm paddling at least twice a week. Like, I've taken maybe a couple weeks off. I'm at least hitting, like, small creeks or doing flat water. I guess I don't take it with me on my flat water. So I'm not a good example of putting something away and then testing it out. But I remember when I was a raft guide and I didn't really do year-round boating, I would check my throw bag. And I was probably more diligent then because I was a climber. And I think I was really mindful of checking equipment, how you would with like your climbing rope and your climbing hardware. If I took a season off, I would probably need a reminder to check my gear as a boater.
I've always been really bad at those preseason throw bag tosses. So I'm going to tell you guys, I'm going to get off this podcast. I'm going to go outside and throw a throw bag.
You're going
to
do it?
I'm going to do it. Just to, because I know I need to do it.
No, it's, I agree. I mean, it's do as I say, not as I do, but.
We're giving advice here, Zach.
I just wanted to let people know that like
it's my first couple runs, but I will, just because of like training and stuff that we do with staff, I'll inevitably throw some early in the season. It may just not be right before my first one's out, which it should be.
We're doing training next week. So I have to be an example for others, an example throw. So I'm going to need to practice to get that up. But I think we all struggle with it. It's not something that we want to do because stuffing a throw bag back is not fun. Nobody enjoys it.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
Yeah, people would throw a lot more practice throws if it was easy to stuff throw bags.
Yeah. Right? An additional, if you're really OCD and you haven't a lot of extra time, what I like to...
if you're OCD and you're bored, I have something for you to do.
Sometimes I'm like that, but... So I try to be really organized, which I think comes from like working at Orange Torpedo. Is our shop was so organized and like everything's in buckets or spaces. So I try to do that with my garage. And usually around this time of year, I try to do like a spring cleaning type thing where I'm giving away old gear or just, you know, general spring cleaning. But I also like to reorganize like my overnight gear and like my raft overnight gear versus my kayak overnight gear. And I found that it reduces a lot of stress if all of a sudden you, for whatever reason, you have a 3-day weekend and you're like, oh, let's do what, a rafting trip or a kayaking trip, and you're not having to spend all night trying to figure out where your lightweight self-support gear is and taking it apart from your rafting self-support gear. So I just like have Tupperware that's labeled with duct tape and try to keep pretty much like if you grab the bucket, you have everything for your self-support trip. And that has made things really awesome. And it's also made it so that I don't forget anything. And the additional OCD thing is I actually have a spreadsheet on my computer that like I check off all the gear that I'm supposed to bring as like a minimum, like I'll be able to make it. And that's been really helpful for those last minute trips for people that, you know, work 9-to-5 jobs and then all of a sudden have an opportunity to go.
Wow, you're saying you are OCD?
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Well, in some ways, not in every way.
I'm a huge believer in checklists, but for like personal stuff, I just like to organize things by shelves. So it's like if I'm doing this kind of a trip, I'm just going to clean everything off this shelf, and that means I probably have everything. and if there's stuff on the shelf, then I probably forgot something. Like
you must have a lot of different shelves because you're a rafter, a kayaker, a skier.
Like mountain biker.
Mountain biker. That takes a lot of shelves.
Well, sometimes some of them are tubs. I've got tubs too. Okay.
Tubs, so,
Tubs and or shelves. Yeah. And also seasons. So like right now we've got the ski shelf inside and it's like I'm going skiing and it's for me and two kids and my wife. And it's like we're going to pack up, you know, like a gazillion gloves, bunch of goggles, like all this stuff. So we just have this like shelf in one of our rooms that has all the ski stuff. And you can just walk in and it's like if there's stuff on the shelf, then you forgot to pack something. which so far has been reasonably successful this year.
Nice.
Only occasionally have we not had everything.
Well, I think my system, well, not my, it's actually a combination of Jake and I's system. So I think originally was like the shelf system, and I would overpack, and then we'd try to fit like five or six people in a car and be driving to like California, and I'd be the person that was taking extra room.
You can't bring your tub then.
Yeah. So our system kind of developed like we'll have everything that we absolutely need in this tub, and then that goes into the tub doesn't go in the car, but that has everything that we need as a minimum. And then if we're not a fully packed car, then we can add some extra like luxury items. So it helps me pare down my overpacking habits.
Can I tell you guys what non-OCD people do?
Forget things.
Sometimes. That's true. I have on my wall in my garage, I just have a list of the things I need. It's just like boat, paddle, a warmth, which for me includes dry suit, if I'm bringing a dry suit, shoes, PFD, helmet, skirt.
Oh, I like the list thing.
And even if I go supping, like boat means sup, and I need a sup paddle anywhere. If I'm going rafting, like boat would include maybe oars or whatever, but I just have like 8 things, because that's more, like I could go on a multi-day trip and forget like, I don't know, duct tape and be like, well, we'll be fine. But you can't forget a skirt. Like those are the things you need day to day. It's more common that people forget a helmet on a day trip, or that I would, than I would anything on a multi-day. Because Yeah, you're thinking about it.
Yeah, I actually start, so a lot of those trips, what I'll do is I start sort of like a visual thing. Like I start at my feet and work my way up.
Yeah.
And just check that I've got everything. It's like, okay, start at my feet. So I've got shoes and socks. Okay. Then, you know, move up. Like what's the next thing? And just work up to my head. And, you know, by the time I get there, I usually have everything I need.
But when you do that, skirt doesn't – I forget skirt by doing that method sometimes.
I do too, actually. It's weird. But I'll have to figure out why that is.
Yeah. What happens, I've noticed, is I'm like so excited to go boating that I can't think straight sometimes when we're leaving. And so I just like, I'm like, okay, what do I need? And I forget stuff just because I'm not like thinking straight. I'm just excited to get
I do that. I do that with ski boots at least like 3 times a year.
No, that's horrible.
So it's like I literally won't forget anything, but at least 3 times a year I'll forget my ski boots. The only thing I'll forget all season. Ski boots when it comes to, yeah. I don't know why. Has been.
Back to safety gear. I want to talk to you guys about one specific item I've been learning about this year. I have to give a presentation on Prussic next week. I've been asked to do a presentation on Prussic. And so I've been doing a ton of research.
Who calls you up and says, hey, I want you to give a presentation on Prussic? who are you hanging out with?
No. We're doing that in International Rafting Federation class next week. Okay. And I'm taking the instructor part. So I'm learning to be an International Rafting Federation raft instructor. And each of the instructor candidates have to give 2 classes during the thing to show that they can teach and share things. And they you know things. And so my 2 classes, one is Prussic, and they're both half an hour. One is Prussic, and one is river hydrology. Oh, right?
The hydrology one would be fun.
And that's like an hour long worth of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Fitting into half an hour. Prussic is like 8 minutes. I have to make half an hour.
So you got to think of a lot of uses for the Prussic.
Yeah, or just like a lot, just like the right rope to use and all these things. I've learned some super interesting things I'd love to share as you pack your Prussic. To think about. First of all, you don't want synthetic Prussic because they melt. So you want just like regular old-fashioned rope. And for swiftwater rescue for whitewater stuff, all it has to be is less than the diameter of the rope it's attaching to. So the Prussic line, the little loop, should be smaller than the main rope. That's a good rule of thumb. But 50 to 60% diameter is even better. That's what you're shooting for, is 50 to 60%.
Because you're getting more grip.
The more
without itching.
It's like a 2-to-1, isn't it? That you want basically double the diameter on your main rope versus your Prussic cords.
Well, it depends on. I mean, the reason you want bigger diameter is because the Prussic's stronger, but it's actually more likely to slip if it's bigger. The smaller the diameter of the Prussic, the more likely it is to grip.
Yeah.
So like a good medium between like gripping really well, like because if it grips too well, you can't get it undone. So if it's too small, it grips really well. It's hard to undo. If it's too big, it might slip more. So 50% is a good amount to have like a strong Prussic and have it, you know, grip the right amount, but be able to move it as well later on. But the most interesting thing I've learned through all this research is there's new technology, and there's this stuff called AutoBlock, or have you guys heard of this? Sterling makes it. It's a Prusik that's a sewn loop, and sewn loops are also better too, because when you sew the rope together, it's stronger than if you tie a knot there. Like the double fisherman's knot weakens it. So if you can buy the sewn loops, they're like $8 or $12. And they make this thing called, I think it's called AutoBlock. I'll put a link in the on the
Hollow Block?
Hollow Block, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a squarish rope that is easier to work with, and it grips better too.
Oh, so, yeah.
I'm going through now all of our safety kits and replacing everything with Hollow Block just to make our life easier. And
yeah, they've got them on Backcountry for like $8.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple $12. Sizes. I think you want the bigger size if I remember right. But
yeah, that's cool.
The other thing about the sewn loop is, you know, when you're doing a Prusik, a lot of times that big knot gets in your way. You have to constantly think about where that knot is, where it's less of a concern with this sewn loop. So like I said, we're going through all of our safety kits right now, taking out our old Prusiks. And Prusiks over, you know, 10 years, 15 years do get kind of old, and they should be replaced anyway. And replacing them with this Hollow Block, is that what it was?
Yeah, Hollow Block. Yeah, Sterling. Yeah. Sterling Hollow, H-O-L-L-O-W.
Yep.
Hollow Block. And this would take way less space. Like, if you're going to throw these in your life jacket or even in your repair kit, just because you don't have the knot on them, like, they'll just pack a ton smaller. Huh. This is cool.
Yep. And I've been reading about using Prusiks to ascend ropes, which I did back when I was young. But just have you guys ever tried ascending a rope with a Prusik instead of an ascender?
Yeah. It's tough.
It's really tough. But yeah. I've been realizing... Like, if you ever, I haven't been in the situation where I need to climb a rope out of a canyon, but if I ever was, it'd be kind of nice to have two with you in your PFD that you could use to ascend a rope for some reason. So I'm going to start putting these Hollow Block Prusiks in a pocket of my PFD for the time when I have to get rescued out of a canyon and ascend a rope.
Better start practicing your pull-ups.
it's hard. It's not easy.
It's really hard.
It's better than climbing a rope.
Yeah.
Like climbing a rope, especially if it's vertical, is brutal. Where with Prusiks, it's hard, but you can just take 45 minutes and eventually you'll make it.
Yeah.
You can just like rest.
Well, if you have
a
really long sling, and I'm trying to remember from climbing, really long sling and an ascender, that's the easier way to do it. Because then you're using your foot to leverage your upper body up there. But I'm just not going to bring, if I'm ever on a mission that's that difficult, that I'm bringing an ascender and a sling to get out of a vertical canyon. Like, I don't know what I'm doing.
I will never do that in my life. My life is at a point where I will never do any river where I need an ascender. That's a good rule of thumb for me.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm going to say, no, I'm good. And stay home and watch Game of Thrones.
Not Eric Boomer.
yeah. But sometimes, there's times, you know, like, where maybe having to get up at, like, somebody may have to throw a throw bag down that you, like, climb up. And having those, like... You know, I'm not, you know, I don't think I can climb a rope anymore. So I'm not going to climb a rope out unless it's like a 45 degree angle. But having those Prusiks handy would be kind of cool. Or if like you're helping somebody else out. So I'm more become a fan of carrying those in my PFD, those Hollow Block ones.
Yeah, seem like a cool thing. Something similar to the Hollow Block that I've carried, which is not like to preface, is really not great for ropes, is a Tiblock, which is basically a really lightweight aluminum thing that goes around the rope that has teeth, which acts the same as a Prusik, but just doesn't slip because it's actually like teething into the rope. So if you're putting a lot of weight or force against it, it's going to tear up your rope, but it's a good, like in a stitch, if you have nothing else, it's a good tool, and it weighs like nothing.
Is it also really a pulley, cheap. Priscilla, or is it
No, it's not a pulley. Yeah, it's just it's essentially a metal Prusik that you can attach a carabiner or a line to, and just have it as a locking mechanism.
But by the time if you do one of these things, I mean, it takes up hardly any more space, and it's, you know, the weight is negligible.
Right.
And yeah, it is a better deal.
Is it? It's a progress capture type thing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
I have a pulley like that. It's a pulley, but also captures the progress built in.
Oh,
so you can do, you can like if you're pulling a rope off of a raft off of a rock or something, and you just want to get straight one to one, if you just pull on the rope, like, you have to give up your progress. But if it runs through the pulley, and it can do what you guys are talking about and do a direction change. Or you could put the pulley in the boat and do the 2-to-1 and do a progress capture as well.
Hmm. Cool.
So I carry that. It's kind of a nerdy thing. I've never used it. I'm looking forward to some day where I'm like, oh, cool, I get to pull that piece of hardware out. But in theory, I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Well, we got any other big, you know, seasons coming? Think about things to think about?
Something cool that happened. If you live near the North Santa Am and you want to dust the rust off, Sam Drevo and a bunch of us put up slalom gates just below Big Cliff Dam. And it's not really in a rapid, and I seriously misjudged how difficult just doing slalom gates well in class one is. And it is a workout. So the gates are up right now, and if you want to run them, just get a hold of Sam Drevo and he can lower them. And it's a really good practice course. And then, of course, if you want to continue downstream, you get to run the Niagara section, which is a class 3-4 section with two bigger class 4 rapids.
It sounds scary. I don't like it being called the Niagara section.
Oh, it's not scary. It's like a fun training backyard run. I don't know why it's called Niagara.
Why would they call it that?
I don't know. Okay. There's a history. There's a history there somewhere. We'll find it. Right. I think there is a town called Niagara. I don't know. I'm making that up. Right. I'll figure out the real information.
Well, at least you didn't say it somewhere that it's being recorded. So as the season's coming, you know, one of the things that I know I start doing right now is thinking about what are the trips that I really want to knock off this year? What are the things I want to do? And Priscilla, as sort of you too, Zach, I think, is people who really plan kind of the big expeditions or the abstract places to go, that kind of thing. What are the things this time of year that it's like, I'm going to go do this run on this date and I'm going to start planning with my friends around, you know, the 5th of July, we're going to go do this. Mm. Or is your process a little bit grayer, more tentative? Like maybe we're going to go here. We're for sure going to boat on this date, but here's 5 options. Like what is your process on planning out those things this time of year?
Well, that's it's a great question.
Everything, all those things.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's some run. Well, so I'll say like, you know, the Sierras is a good example of one where you want a bunch of backup options. Of course, if you are a gnarly boater, you don't need as many backup options because you can run something higher than I would be comfortable with. But for like Jacob and I, we have a list of things. We generally have time off at, you know, the end of June and the beginning of June and the end of June. So we're hoping that within those two time frames, there'll be a few runs off of our list that we'll be running. And we use backup information from people who've done it previously. Like Darren McCoy has a post on his blog about when they ran what California runs and what flow they were at and like how much snowpack there was. So you can kind of correlate that to what it looks like this year and be like, oh, X Creek, like the feather's going to be at a normal water level at this time of year because it was that way in 2006 and had similar snowpack conditions. And obviously, if you get a permit for like Idaho, you're hoping that it lines up for what your permit dates are. So we have a few friends that are doing trips like that, and hopefully that works out too. And then in Oregon, who knows? I mean, a lot of the problems in Oregon is if the creek is running, it may not be accessible if there's still snow at the put-in and the road's not plowed. So there's that variable too.
I have two plans this year. One is to run the Minim. Like hike in and do the long section of the Minim and the Wallawas. Hmm. And we have a date set and, you know, there's 4 of us and it's either going to go or not go. Like if, you know, this is when we were all kind of planning on it and we all know it might not happen, but we all kind of set this date aside to do it. And then there's also like some bigger Calmeopsis trips I want to do that are huge hike-ins and incredibly date specific. You know, that the snow has to be melted just right. The flow has to be just right. We want weather. That I have like a handful of people that are kind of on call for the exact.
Are you trying to do Tin Cup Creek?
Don't talk about it.
It's okay. I'm not going to do it.
Well, it's one of the last, I think, first descents in there. I'm not even sure it's a first descent, but somebody told me they did it on an air mattress once, which I'm not sure if I believe that.
I'm sure some crazy Southern Oregon person hiked in there with an air mattress.
Growing up, I had some friends that, I was like an early high school, middle schooler, and they were some older guys. I mean, they were big climbers, like they'd done Denali and Aconcagua and some of that kind of stuff. And they were kind of mid-level kayakers, but they invited me to go into the Calamiopsis a couple different times for different things. To float on like Thermarests. Like, that's what they do. They go float. They like dry bags, backpacks, and they did the Chetco, like the full Chetco on like basically air mattresses in the summer. They take like 6 days and do it. And they said it was awesome. I never actually got to go with them, but I know they did a bunch of stuff back there. Like Thermarests.
There's a group that did the Chetco every year. They sent me the photos from their trips from back in the day. They're pretty cool. They just walk around the rapids, float the flats. They spent like 8 days doing it.
So it, you bring up air mattresses in the Calamiopsis, it's entirely possible that didn't happen.
There's actually four different things in the Calamiopsis I want to go do. I would do any of them. They range from like just mildly annoyingly challenging to just like potentially a terrible trip, you know, where
full supper fest.
Yeah, they're full on supper fests. But in really cool places. So I have a couple of those just on the back burner if the conditions are right. And I can, you know, the conditions are right. And then I call a bunch of people and everybody says, no, we don't do it. But magically it might happen. The other, Priscilla, I definitely want to go do North Fork Silver like you guys did a few years ago.
Yeah, well. I'm hoping to get a wood report there soon. I think had a friend who flew over the drainage and said it looked like there was a ton of wood on the banks, kind of like what you'd expect with windfall, but she didn't notice. I mean, you know, she's flying, so she can't specifically say if there's a lot of wood or not, particularly in those gorges, but she made it sound like there wasn't too much that she could see on Silver Creek from this, like that was in the stream itself, but there was a lot of downed trees on the bank. So if there was heavy rain or snow melt, that stuff might end up in the creek, but they're not sure.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping someone maybe hiking up the trail or something could give a report before committing to that run. Cause that would be, there's some spots where it'd be a really big bummer to not be able to have a reasonable portage option.
Yeah. Yep. So there's a bunch of stuff there. The other one that's a trip that a lot of people love to do is the Middle Feather. I know, Priscilla, you guys were trying to go there last year, and you either want to catch, I mean, there's a small window of flows for that one.
Well, people just went this last weekend.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I don't know what the water level was, but the pictures made it look pretty awesome. That's definitely on our list as well.
And for, I mean, I like it in the 1500 and lower range, like 1200 and dropping is perfect. And so to catch a river at this exact flow
it's tough.
And to find the people that can drive that far away, but it's certainly worth it. It's an amazing trip. So that's on my radar for this spring, but it just, you know, when is it going to flow and be exactly perfect?
Yeah.
It's tough.
Do you guys have any gear of the week that we should move on to?
Right.
As the season gets going.
I don't have gear of the week. I'm moving on to thing of the week because I don't have enough gear of the weeks anymore. And there's another Whitewater podcast. Have you guys heard about this? Some guys in the East are doing a rafting and small raft podcast.
Cool. Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think 3 episodes. I listened to the first one. I'm going to try to listen to the other ones. But it's pretty cool to hear people talking about rafting and that kind of thing. So I forget the name of it right now, too. But I'll put a link into our notes so people can check that one out, too.
Awesome. Priscilla, do you have a thing of the week?
Oh, man. I did try to think about this last night, and I couldn't actually come up with anything that unique. And I think it's mostly because my brain is just completely fried this last couple weeks. So, unfortunately, I don't have a good gear of the week this time, but I promise next time I will think of something new.
So, I haven't... Well... Well, I got two things. One, an update, and then a gear thing that I got to play with a little bit. So a while back, I said Bedrock Sandals, maybe the new Chacos. And I had some guides use them, love them. I bought a pair. I'm going on a trip next week, so I'm actually going to use them because I still have like 10 feet of snow at my house, so I haven't really worn them much except for around the house. And so far, I'm pretty mixed on whether I'm sold, but I'll update back on that one. But anyway, so they look like, just inspecting them though, like they look really well made. They're, you know, super grippy sole. Like there's a lot to like.
One of our guides got some, and I got a report today, and she said they're comfortable, they're pretty cool. You don't want to walk for a long ways on with them. So like Chacos, you might go on, like travel through Thailand with, for example, because they have tons of support. Yeah. These don't have much support, so they're really good for like you might use flip flops, but. Mm-hmm. Over long periods, they're not that comfortable.
They do have a couple different footbeds, and one of them looked really flat, and the other one does have a bit more support to it. So I bought the Pro, I think, which has more support.
Okay.
I also noticed they come super small. Like I wore like a 10 to 10.5 in everything, and I ordered these in an 11, and they're like border, like almost too small. And the comfort thing so far, I'm not sure. Anyway, I'll report back after some real use.
Awesome.
The other thing, I was hanging out with somebody this week, and we use satellite communicators on our trips, you know, like the DeLorme deals for, you know, sat devices. And Garmin's come out with one now that is really tiny. Like, it's really tiny. It's like the size of a watch almost.
Oh.
It's a little bit bigger, and you don't put it on your wrist or anything, but it's like that's the size of it. But it Bluetooths to your phone, and according to this guy who's tested it along with the bigger ones, it actually gets better reception than the bigger ones, and it's fully waterproof, so he puts it in his life jacket.
Wow.
So he just boats. It's like this tiny little thing, throws it in his life jacket and boats with it. So I'm really intrigued with those. I think I'm going to try and get one this year to test out, but we love the bigger ones. And if this has better reception and basically does the same thing, but in a totally waterproof, like throw it in your life jacket version, that sounds like a slam dunk.
Yeah, I've seen this one before. Yeah. I think it's the InReach Mini.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That's the one. I'm looking at the website right now. Yeah,
his said Garmin on it, but I think Garmin InReach are the same thing.
But you have to, if you want to do a text, you have to Bluetooth your phone. Is there any way to?
Probably. You can use do it the SOS. You can hit the SOS button on it.
Yeah.
So it's like a spot.
There's no type pad. If you don't have your phone, you can't. I think you could do the preset messages, like if you pre-selected them or whatever, because there's a little screen, but you couldn't like type one. But I don't.
Yeah, it says you can send and receive text messages anywhere.
Yeah.
Track movement, share location, pair with devices, 3.5 ounces. That's pretty cool.
So for me, I've used ones like this where you have to pair to your phone. I know people swear by, they say it's fine, it works. For me, I really struggle. Like my phone doesn't pair for some reason.
Mm.
Yeah, you have to have a special app, and the app isn't updated when you turn it on. You have to, you know, I just always struggled. I'm really a fan of the devices where you can, even if it's unwieldy, you can send a message from the device without a phone.
Yeah. I bet, I mean, for the price, it seems like this one probably has the preset message option.
You can do them in the account. You preset the messages in the account, and it syncs up to there. So it's really easy to do that. So we have those with ours.
Cool.
I will say we've been using them now for a couple of years, and mine's always paired up pretty easily with my phone.
So Eric, but also when you send on the trips, they have to pair with your guide's phones as well.
Yeah.
So that means your guides have to have the app, and they have to.
Well, whoever the head guide is, I just haven't put it on theirs, and maybe it's backup. But again, once it's on there once, then you're all connected and stuff. It's I found them to be pretty stinking user friendly, like more user friendly than dealing with a sat phone, to be honest.
Yeah,
sat phones, the old ones are tough. I remember not being able to get the old school ones to work a couple times.
Huh.
Well. Unless you guys have anything else, I think we are running low on time.
I think we pulled another one off, guys.
Right.
Nice work.
Nice. Well, thanks for hanging out. Hopefully the sun is out where you are and the snow is starting to melt and the rivers are coming up and you're going boating. Hop on to wherever you listen to podcasts, rate us, leave comments. I don't know. Do whatever people do in those kinds of scenarios. You'll find links to today's topics, maybe some of those items that we talked about, on the website at therivertalkpodcast.com. You can shoot us an email, therivertalkpodcast@gmail.com. Otherwise, go out, have a great week, and we will be back.